in God's name do you need to solve it for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham.
Good morning, Mark Latham. How are you?
Good, thanks, Brent. Good to be with you.
Likewise. Nice to have you with us. I see the Prime Minister has accused the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, of, in his words, nastiness over the coalition's ongoing attacks on visas granted to Palestinians and the security risks presented by unchecked individuals who arrive here. The tit for tat continues, Mark.
Well, it's a question of national security, and I thought it was extraordinary during the week in Parliament that Albanese was asked, is it acceptable for someone to support Hamas and gain one of these visas and entry to Australia? And he couldn't answer that question. Now, if you're talking about the safety of the Australian people, I would have thought anyone with common sense would say, if you're a supporter of a terrorist organisation and you're applying to get out of Gaza and come to Australia, your application will be rejected. We've got to have a guarantee that any of the Gazan refugees are actually against terrorism, they're against violence, they come to Australia for legitimate reasons, and there are no security and safety risks to the Australian people. Isn't that Albanese's job? His first responsibility to keep our people safe, rather than an open-door policy where apparently, according to what the Prime Minister didn't say, he could quite possibly be a supporter of a terrorist organisation and still get into Australia.
Yes, it beggars belief, doesn't it? It really does. And I think Australians en masse are fed up with this approach.
Well, the Albanese government has had a number of security failures with people who were released from detention and committed serious crimes in the community. Instead of keeping people safe, they failed on that front. And I think it's an even bigger failure to have 1,300 Gazan refugees applying to come to Australia and now 500 who want to stay here permanently without proper security vetting. These people didn't have face-to-face interviews. They were given tourism visas, which seems ridiculous. And you look at the data, Australia's taking many, many more of these people under Albanese than the Middle Eastern nations themselves. I would have thought the proper approach is for the Middle East to look after these refugees first and foremost, and only in the safest of circumstances, only in emergency circumstances, would Australia take any of them.
I see, Mark, that Peter Dutton is reportedly seeking legal advice on whether he can sue Zali Steggall for calling him racist. She got in on the bandwagon as well.
Well, I think that's wrong. I think Peter Dutton's taken the right stance about these refugee applications and Gazans who want to come to Australia. He's talking as a former Home Affairs Minister with experience with this. He knows these people need to be vetted in a serious way. It shouldn't just be sort of a tick and flick exercise. You need to interview them. You need to give the Australian people every possible guarantee that there's no risk to community safety. So Peter Dutton has got the right stance. That's not a racist stance. But I don't like the idea of members of Parliament suing each other for things that are said. They've got parliamentary forums to sort all this out. Zali Steggall can make 100 speeches about Peter Dutton and he can make 100 responses. So rather than, you know, lining the pockets of lawyers with this sort of thing, Dutton should stick to his policy issues and not worry too much about Zali Steggall. I think most Australians know it's not racism to talk about our national security and safety, and Zali Steggall's just after a headline there. So how about they just leave it to parliamentary debate and the policy debate rather than a legal stoush?
Well said. It's been a case closely watched by the transgender community and legal minds alike today, or this week, I should say, in the Federal Court of Australia. A judge ruled in favour of trans woman Roxanne Tickle in her anti-discrimination case against a social media app. Much of the proceedings centred around what constitutes a woman under Australian law, and whether someone's sex can be changed. The federal court justice found that Tickle was indirectly discriminated against on the basis of her gender identity when she was removed from women-only social media app Giggle for Girls, Mark.
Well, the case name in itself was comical, Tickle versus Giggle.
Yes.
But Roxanne Tickle, who used to be Ross Tickle, and you've got to say, on appearance, still looks like a man, on gender identity, applied to be part of this female app, Giggle for Girls, and it led to a case where he was removed from the app and he took anti-discrimination action against the Yap owner or runner, Sal Grover. So the case ended up as Tickle versus Giggle, which is in a giggle in itself, of course. But the serious thing is that the Gillard government changed the law some 12 years ago to say that gender discrimination now is on the basis of how a person identifies. If you're a man who says he feels like a woman, wants to be a woman, then that identification, according to the law, makes him a woman. So biological sex has been thrown out the window by that Gillard government amendment to the Anti-Discrimination Act. And as a result, the court made the correct decision in this case, but it's left a lot of Australians wondering that if you're male, biologically, shouldn't that be the main test rather than just putting your hand up with self-identification to say, no, I'm a woman and I want access to female apps, female toilets, female change rooms. You know, this has got consequences in other respects. So I'd like to see a future government change the law back to where it was, that the question of what is a woman is based on biological sex rather than self-identification, as Roxanne Tickle engaged in.
Labor's handpicked panel of domestic violence experts says the government must pursue a total ban on gambling advertising and introduce stronger pokies regulation if it wants to get serious about protecting women after community uproar over the spate of female killings earlier this year. That was a story this week, Mark.
Well, I don't see any evidence in the community, Brent, that someone playing pokies makes them a domestic violence perpetrator. There's a lot of responsible gamblers out there. Sure, there's people with problem gambling. But the research just takes parts of Western Sydney and says, oh, look, there's a high concentration of pokie machines and there's also a relatively high incidence of domestic violence. That doesn't prove causation. That doesn't mean that someone sitting on the pokies this afternoon putting a few dollars through is more likely to engage in domestic violence. What if you went out to Bourke and Wilcannia, where they don't have poker machines, or not many of them, but very, very high rates of domestic violence? Well, does that prove the opposite? So I think this is a ridiculous recommendation. The committee set up by Albanese wants more research done into domestic violence. I mean, this has been researched inside out over decades, and we know the most likely predictor of a domestic violence perpetrator is someone who's done it previously, been charged, and spent jail time. So the biggest solution to this is not about gambling ads, it's not about poker machines. It's about ensuring that anyone who's jailed or convicted for domestic violence actually spends a long time out of the community. I mean, you can't commit domestic violence if you're in jail. The sentences are too light. Community service orders are inadequate. And the best way of protecting women in these circumstances is to ensure that offenders spend a lengthy time in jail.
I saw one of the headlines this week, Mark, and it took me back. It said basically, and I paraphrase here, but all domestic violence perpetrators should be treated exactly the same way as terrorists.
Well, I think that's a massive exaggeration. It's a law and order offence, of course, to hit someone, to engage in domestic violence, but it's a world apart from people who conspire to blow up buildings or fly planes into buildings or cause damage on a scale affecting hundreds of people. So terrorism, of course, is the greatest threat to the safety of the Australian people on a mass scale. Domestic violence is serious. It's a problem. But I don't think hysteria is the solution to it. Declaring a national emergency, all this sort of talk, doesn't make a difference. If there's a man out there bad enough and evil enough to hit a woman this afternoon, is he less likely to do it because some politician declared a national emergency? No, those things are ridiculous. So a lot of this debate actually makes it harder to solve the domestic violence issues in the community, which primarily are up to the police. I see there's a club in Sydney that's training its staff to identify these problems and intervene. I think that's pretty risky for the staff members. It's best left to the police. It's best left to beefing up the penalties for domestic violence and ensuring that the perpetrators are not free in the community. So a lot of this hysteria and recommendations from committees and things you hear about it are actually a distraction from the main task.
Thayer, this was reported in other papers. I was reading it in the Canberra Times, and it said that federal ministers spent the day avoiding the T word, obviously standing for terrorist word, after the domestic violence commissioner said family violence offenders should be tracked like terrorists.
Well, I don't exactly know what that means. If you know someone's about to commit domestic violence, then tell the police. and the police would intervene and take the appropriate action. You can get silly with this stuff, and you can get so hysterical about it that you're making it harder for the police to do their job. So I don't know what tracking people means. If someone's committed the offence, they belong in jail. You know, we should have zero tolerance of any man who hits a woman. It's just a dreadful thing, no matter the circumstances, no matter what excuse they might put forward. Keep your hands to yourself. If you do it, I think they belong in jail. And if there's someone likely to do it, tell the police. There's no other solution to this, Brent. I mean, you know, common sense, law and order is the best solution to these sorts of problems, rather than people just sort of engaging in ridiculous comments.
Let's talk about the US presidential race. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says he's no longer going to campaign for the 2024 US presidential election, but he will not formally apparently end his bid. Huh? I don't understand it. But anyway, what he has basically said is that he has put his support behind Donald Trump.
Yeah, he's appearing at Trump rallies and telling his supporters, independents out there formally supporting the Democrat Party, to back Trump. I mean, it's a pretty big condemnation of the Democrats. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of iconic Democrat family, with Robert Kennedy and the uncle John F. Kennedy. It's a big thing, isn't it, for him to come out and say these things to support Donald Trump. But he's doing it on the basis the Democrats have been captured by wealthy elites, by donors. They no longer represent working people. They support foreign adventurous wars that Kennedy is against. So you might say he's sort of an old Democrat, a traditional Democrat, disillusioned with the way the party's gone under Obama, then Biden, and now Kamala Harris. So it's a big plus for Donald Trump, but at the same time, Kamala Harris is getting a huge honeymoon period in the mainstream media in America. They look like they had a pretty successful convention in Chicago, and I'd expect in coming weeks she'll pull ahead of Trump in the polls, and it's a real contest.
It is a real contest. The latest polls, this is as of the 22nd of August, so what are we today? August 25, so 3 days ago. The latest polls, this poll was taken over a 10-day period. They have Kamala Harris at 48.4%, Donald Trump 45.3%. So it's closer than what Mr. Trump would like.
Yeah, and when Trump had that assassination attempt and then his successful convention, and the Democrats were torn apart by whether or not Biden would stay and recontest, it looked like Trump was a shoo-in. But American politics is changing quickly. We're still a long way from the election in November. They talk about the October surprise. I just think that, you know, to make a judgment about this, you'll need to look at the polls and the state of play in late October. So a long way to go, but it's fast-moving, their politics, and it's a real contest now, and it's going to be fascinating how Trump lines up against Harris.
Tanya Plibersek made the headlines this week for probably all the wrong reasons. Firstly, she effectively banned the $1 million coal mine in New South Wales, although she is not saying it was banned. That's effectively what happened. But in the same week, she's approved in the Northern Territory a 120 square kilometre solar farm for Mike Cannon Brooks. And this 120 kilometre solar farm, with the electricity that's generated from it, if it ever gets off the ground, it's going off to Singapore. So we won't be able to power our toasters or our coffee makers of a morning as a direct result of this solar farm. But people in Singapore will be able to, Mark.
Well, it's a strange development, isn't it? In the name of saving the environment, we're going to wallpaper thousands of square kilometres of the Australian outback with these solar panels, with metal objects, and say, oh, this is saving the planet. When you look at some of the photographs in places like China, these sort of solar farms roll over the hill and down the other side, and the whole landscape is completely covered by solar panels. It's a very, very land-intensive way of generating electricity compared to a nuclear power plant or a gas plant or a coal plant, which don't take up much space at all. So there is an environmental damage from mass solar farm panels. And then there's the question of what do you do with them when they have their lifespan ended in 20, 25 years' time. And it's a massive recycling task. And the prospect that they're put into landfill, the chemicals leak into the water systems and the like. So solar farms have an environmental cost. But that doesn't seem to be factored into the decision-making, while at the same time, the gold mine in New South Wales, which seemed legitimate. The local Aboriginal Land Council was supporting it. It's knocked on the head. So these are very strange decisions in the name of the environment, I've got to say.
And with this solar farm, Mark, there's 800 kilometres of transmission lines that need to be run. 800 kilometres of transmission lines. And with the situation in Blaney, I think it was something like 13 kilometres of transmission lines needed to be run. And that was a problem for Tanya Plibersek.
Well, how do you hook up a Northern Territory solar farm to provide electricity in Singapore? I would have thought of thousands of kilometres of transmission wires and running them on the ocean bed. So it's a very complex project. Why does Australia want to export electricity to Singapore? It's in the commercial interests of Mike Cannon Brooks, this billionaire tech guy who now thinks he can save the planet. I don't see how these are decisions in the Australian national interest. I'd rather have a gold mine providing jobs in New South Wales, and I'd rather have proper land use whereby we've got, say, a nuclear power plant, which is emission-free on a very small patch of land, instead of this practice now of solar farms and metal objects that extend as far as the eye can see.
The Sydney Metro, Monday morning, the new Sydney Metro officially opened its turnstiles to the public, attracting tens of thousands of Sydneysiders to use the service. I see there have been more than 200,000 passengers boarding the Metro every day this week, with 99% of services being on time. Many have said the Metro is efficient. They love it.
Yeah, it's subject of a bit of hysteria itself. You know, anyone who lives in the inner city, they've gone crazy about this metro. But in practice, the worst transport problems in Sydney are in the outer areas. You go to southwest Sydney and you can see traffic jams spanning kilometres for people trying to get off Narellan Road onto the M5. That's where you've got the real transport blockages in Sydney. The metro in itself is simply a second railway crossing of Sydney Harbour. We've got one that runs across the Harbour Bridge, of course. And this is the second one. It's got five stations attached to it. But you'd think, listening to the media and some of the advocates, that it's the biggest thing since sliced bread. So I think there's a bit of metro hysteria. Over time, that'll settle down. And I'd rather see some public transport spending in the outer parts of Sydney, where you've got traffic problems that are absolutely horrendous, population growth, suburbs that aren't coping. I think we've got to put the debate back in a bit of perspective as to where the real problems are.
And last but not least, let's talk about Ron Coote. They say history squares the ledger eventually, and so it was, with South Sydney and Eastern Suburbs International Ron Coote being named the 14th immortal in a big dinner, a sparkly dinner, on Wednesday night at the SCG, Mark.
Well, Brent, you're a South Sydney Rabbitohs supporter. They're having a terrible season this year, but they did have a golden era. And Ron Coote is the first immortal recognised from that team that was so successful from 1967 to 1971, and he's been a good contributor to the game, setting up the Men of League Foundation, which looks after retired rugby league players who didn't make a fortune, didn't invest their money well, and hit upon hard times. So I think that role with the Men of League certainly deserve recognition. So I don't begrudge Ron Coote his recognition, but there's a story in the press today that the naming of the Hall of Fame entrants, 25 of them, was rushed, and they got into a situation where the panel didn't know a lot about the female nominees, and every woman nominated got a gong. And I've got to say, watching the awards ceremony, I followed a lot of rugby league, and I didn't know who those female players were. So, sure, we've got to recognise the importance of female rugby league, but just handing out gongs for the sake of it, I don't think is a solution. So maybe they could do it a bit better next time. But congratulations to Ron Coote for his wonderful career at the Rabbitohs and the Roosters, and in particular the work he's done with the Men of League.
Fantastic. Absolute champion. Absolute champion. And a lovely man. All right, Mark, thank you so much. We appreciate you. You've got a busy day. You're out to Scone.
Yeah, I'm heading west of Scone, out past Sandy Hollow. I'm here for the stallion parades in the racehorse industry, and out there they tell me there's no telephone reception. So I love talking to you on a Sunday morning and your listeners, so it gave me the chance at 9 o'clock rather than 10. So thanks for that.
Pleasure. Enjoy always our chats. Enjoy the rest of your day, mate. We'll talk to you next Sunday.